To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From NPR, it's Latino USA. Every month, we hear the unemployment number. It's just under 10% now, but there are other numbers. And for African Americans and Latinos, those numbers are much worse.
You see that across the board and how people are trying to get by, to try and in essence, wait out the economic downturn.
What the recession means for Latinos and how to make sure jobs are created for everyone in a recovery. Also, border conjunto music, a conversation with Grammy Award winners, Los Tex-Maniacs. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Joining us to discuss the news affecting the Latino community this week is Margaret Lampe. She's a nurse epidemiologist and perinatal HIV prevention expert based at the CDC in Atlanta, Georgia. Hola, Margaret. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you're the lead author on a recently released report that says that Black and Latino babies are at a greater risk for perinatal HIV infection. Basically, that means that they're at a higher risk for becoming infected during the time that they're being carried in pregnancy. And honestly, I immediately said, wait a second, you can prevent a mother transmitting HIV to her baby that she's carrying in utero. What's happening that Latino and African American mothers aren't able to do this as well as white mothers?
Well, that's a great question. And first, let me just preface my comments by saying that we've seen a tremendous decline since the early days of the epidemic in terms of the numbers of children that are acquiring HIV through perinatal transmission. So the overall story is a success story. However, as you mentioned, Black and Latino infants are disproportionately affected much more than white infants. And in reviewing the literature, it does seem that Blacks and Latinas tend to access prenatal care somewhat later than their white counterparts. And for the interventions to be most effective, antiretroviral therapy needs to be initiated early in pregnancy. Also, white women were more likely when they were in care to achieve a viral suppression, meaning of having fewer copies of the virus in their blood, and that's really the number one predictor for whether a woman will transmit HIV infection to her infant or not. So for whatever reason, and it's don't have the, besides later entry into prenatal care, we don't really have the evidence to suggest why Black and, to a lesser extent, Latinas do not achieve that viral suppression that white women are able to achieve.
If you have a Latina teenager who's pregnant, and is already kind of having a hard time dealing with the fact that maybe this was an unintended pregnancy, and she knows that she's HIV positive, or are there chances that she just doesn't even know she's HIV positive and she's pregnant and she just isn't getting the care, or that she's thinking, you know what, my baby's going to get this no matter what, there's nothing I can do to prevent it. So is it a question of education?
That's a really good question, and we really don't know. We do know that some women know that they have HIV infection and opt not to engage in care even during their pregnancy. And that can be most likely an issue of education. We know that women, when they're pregnant, overwhelmingly want to do what's best for their children. We did find in the study that white women were more likely to know if they were HIV infected during their pregnancy, they were more likely than Blacks and, I believe, Hispanics to know before they were pregnant that they had HIV infection. So they were able to avail themselves of the interventions more readily. So one thing that's important for all people in the United States, whether you're pregnant or not, is to get tested and to know your HIV status, preferably before you become pregnant or before you, assuming one chooses to become pregnant, before then.
You're a perinatal HIV prevention expert. That means that as a nurse epidemiologist, you actually know what women need to do who are pregnant in order to not transmit the HIV virus to their babies. What do they need to do?
Well, I would again take it back a step, and I would suggest that all women, particularly Latinas, that they get tested for HIV infection. And we recommend that every person in the United States between the ages of 13 and 64 be tested for HIV at least once. Now, if a woman is HIV infected and considering pregnancy, we can, with medications and cesarean delivery and not breastfeeding, can reduce the risk to less than 1% that a mother would transmit HIV to her baby, which is really amazing when you think about how far we've come since the early days of the AIDS epidemic. In fact, we have a goal in this country to eliminate perinatal HIV transmission, which we define as not zero infections, because as I said, we can expect a risk of 1%, but we have a goal of having fewer than 1 per 100,000 births in this country being HIV infected and a transmission rate of less than 1%. And we have a way to go to do that, but we are certainly on the right track so far.
Margaret Lampe, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Margaret Lampe is a nurse epidemiologist and perinatal HIV prevention expert based in Atlanta at the CDC. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Jobs shape our lives. We move for them, walk picket lines for them, celebrate and curse them. But when jobs disappear, a community can stagnate. Nationwide, 10% of Americans now do not have jobs. But look carefully at two communities, and the picture is even bleaker. The Latino unemployment rate is 12.6%. The African-American rate is 16.5%. So on today's program, we wanted to talk about employment disparities and how they affect relations between these two communities. Joining us is Paul Cuadros. He's a journalist documenting migration in North Carolina. He's also a professor of journalism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome back to the show, Paul.
Thanks, Maria.
And Lidia Gutierrez owns a small business in Detroit. It's a tortilla factory, and she's joining us actually close to the plant floor there. So joining us from Detroit at the Hacienda Mexican Foods plant is Lidia Gutierrez. Welcome back to the show as well.
Thank you.
All right, Paul, we're going to start with you. Paint a picture of what's going on in North Carolina right now.
Well, here in North Carolina, we're at about 11% unemployment. And that's hit the state hard. And I think what's happened in North Carolina in the past 10, 15 years is we've been through, in essence, an economic boom here in North Carolina in terms of construction and agribusiness and agriculture, where the state has really, really grown in terms of new housing, new schools, new offices, new businesses, all of which has basically, in essence, come to a standstill. And this is significant because most Latino immigrants in North Carolina, especially men, work in the construction industry. And so we've seen that industry, in essence, collapse after the housing market burst. And it's really impacted the lives of workers and their families. And you see that across the board in how people are trying to get by, how people are trying to find food, scrape together money, combine resources with their own families or with other families to try and, in essence, wait out the economic downturn.
Are you seeing businesses closing? Are you seeing an exodus of people saying, you know what, I really wanted to stay in this country. My kids are American-born, but, you know, I built that small house in my small pueblo. I'm going to go back and you know, cross my fingers in terms of my kids' education.
Well, we've seen some people go back, but lots and lots of people are staying. You know, for a long time, people, when they were looking at migration of Latinos to the Southeast or to the Midwest, there was this thinking that, you know, once the economy turned down, that those Latino immigrant workers would go back. They'd go back to Mexico or Central America. Some have gone back, but many, many more have stayed. And they're trying to find a way to stay and to hang on and to make their way in this recession. Here in North Carolina, we've lost almost 60,000 jobs in our construction industry in the past 2 years. And that's significant because Latinos make up at least a third of the workforce in construction jobs in North Carolina. So that's really where we're sort of seeing the impact the most for Latino workers and their families. The loss of that construction work is really, really hitting hard and hitting home.
Lidia Gutierrez, you have a small business in Detroit. A lot of people think Detroit and think, you know, yet another time that this city is going to be left a ghost town, you know, no jobs. But what in fact is happening with your tortilla factory and Mexican foods business?
Well, first, I'm very thankful that I'm not in the automotive industry, because everything that Paul said, if you can take that and multiply it by 10 or 100-fold, is the economic situation here in the state of Michigan. It's very chaotic. It is depressing. And we have, as a state, to reinvent ourselves. And the automotive industry is not where it's at anymore. For my particular business, we've had to do some things also to reinvent ourselves. We've had many restaurants that have flourished in this economic time. We're seeing taquerias booming up throughout the state. We're seeing the little taco trucks that are making wave, and they're growing and they're being more and more successful. So we're very thankful to be in this particular industry at this time.
But give me a sense, Lidia. Have you had to let people go, or have you been able to expand your business?
We have continued to grow our business, and so no, we have not let anybody go. We're growing our business here in this market due to finding new products that we could manufacture, doing some additional innovative kinds of things with our products, and not just staying with the same old, but reinventing our packaging and new flavors, and that's been able to help us to sustain our position and continue to grow here in the Detroit area.
But Lidia, you might not have found yourself needing to kind of test these other markets were it not for the fact that this economic downturn basically made you say, look, I've got to do something to make sure that I've got a hand in some other markets. So the recession kind of pushed you?
That's correct, because we realized that, you know, we needed to expand our market, but we saw that there was a tremendous need in and around the city, people needing to work. And so we have a commitment to our community to continue to develop products and to do things in a manner that will help our community to continue to grow.
Paul Cuadros, you actually grew up in Michigan. You now live in North Carolina, but you know a lot about the state of Michigan. So when you hear Lidia Gutierrez talking about the fact that her tortilla factory and her Mexican food and ethnic foods business is growing in Detroit, what's going on for you?
Well, I guess that makes sense, considering that, you know, Michigan has always been the manufacturing heart of the country with regard to the auto industry. And now, you know, we're seeing that industry collapse right before our eyes. I mean, Detroit was the paradise for workers at one point in this country's history, and that's no longer the case. What we're seeing here in North Carolina in terms of Latino immigrant workers and their families is sporadic work. So workers that were once able to rely upon good construction jobs, workers who could work more than 50, 60 hours a week and earn lots of money, we're seeing that collapse to where workers are maybe working 2 days a week. We're also seeing other workers who are working outside their local communities. So they may be living in a town in North Carolina, but traveling farther away, or in some cases out of state, and working throughout the week in a different place, a different location, and then coming back home on the weekends to be with their families. So workers are finding different ways to hold them over in terms of the recession, and they're adapting in how they work, where they work, and in their home lives as well. I've known several families who have moved in together, so relatives will move in together to share expenses for the home. I've known families that have moved out of one rental unit in which maybe they were paying $600 a month for rent into moving into a trailer where they're paying $300 in terms of rent just to sort of, you know, save money and to tide them over during the recession.
I want to ask you again, Lydia, because you did bring up this word depression. And I want you to tell me the story, if there is one, within your community that you know of that kind of encapsulates what you're seeing. Is there one family story that you just kind of can't get out of your mind because of what they've had to do in this recession?
Well, I have a friend who has several rental units and, you know, has to pay property taxes, has a tremendous obligation to paying the money that they owe, and yet many, many of her rental properties are vacant. And, you know, everything that she has, she's put into these rental properties. And unfortunately, as Paul mentioned, you know, people are now moving in, you know, one and two families are moving in together and therefore vacating, you know, the rental properties. And so, you know, somebody like her that's worked so hard to try to be an entrepreneur, try to do something on her own, she's finding it very difficult for renting her properties here, and that's never a good thing.
What do you think? I'll ask you first, Paul, and then you, Lydia. What can, what should Washington do? What would you, I mean, does it have to be, do you turn to the president and say, okay, you're talking about jobs now, but the trickle down of those jobs, and I know that we're, you know, offering counsel to the president, but, or is it to Congress? What are the steps that need to be taken? Let's start with you, Paul.
Well, you know, we passed this stimulus package to stimulate the economy and to get us out of the recession. And it seems to have saved lots and lots of state employee jobs. It saved lots of jobs in terms of teachers, police officers, and other workers who work for the state and are essential to our society. But the other half of that is maybe, you know, a stimulus package. I mean, we had heard talk about shovel-ready projects that could help stimulate the construction industry. That certainly would help tremendously. Lots and lots of construction firms in North Carolina, and we have like 28,000 construction firms in North Carolina, and they're all small businesses. They all employ 20 people or less. And those types of that type of stimulus to that level would go a long way towards helping people in these conditions.
Well, what would be one thing? What would be one thing, Lydia, that you can say, you know, tried and true, actually does create jobs? What would it be?
Well, again, I think for what we're doing, you know, I think it's important that businesses today realize the importance of trying to stimulate the economy by, you know, kind of thinking outside of the box and trying to develop new products that would help them to increase the workforce. If we could see more businesses, you know, trying to make that kind of change, and you know, here in Michigan, we're all about, you know, a local. We're trying to do more local. So, as long as we can continue to you know, buy local and try to you know, energize our local economy, I think that we'll continue to do the right thing.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us on Latino USA. Paul Cuadros in Chapel Hill.
Thank you, Maria.
And Lydia Gutierrez from Detroit.
Muchas gracias, Maria.
Paul Cuadros is a professor of journalism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Lydia Gutierrez owns a tortilla factory in Detroit called Hacienda Mexican Foods. In a minute, Bailando en la Frontera. Dancing on the Border with Grammy Award winners Los Tex-Maniacs. That's coming up in a minute. No se vayan. Stay with us. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. You don't have to be from the Lone Star State to enjoy the conjunto stylings of Los Tex-Maniacs. You just have to want to dance. Founded in 1997 by bajo sexto player Max Baca, this Tejano group is now made up of four instrumentalists: bajo sexto, accordion, bass, and drums. A true blue Texas conjunto.
Marina, 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 te quiero con el corazón. Te quiero por toda la vida, porque tú eres mi adoración. Sabes que te quiero y que nunca te he olvidado. Te lo juro, mi Marina, nunca te olvidaré. Sabes que te quiero y que nunca te he olvidado. Te lo juro, mi Marina, nunca te olvidaré.
On January 31st, the San Antonio-based quartet won their very first Grammy Award for their latest CD entitled Borders y Bailes. And I'm really pleased that two of the Tex-Maniacs join me now from our studios in Austin, Texas. Max Baca and David Farias, welcome back to our program.
It's a great honor and a great pleasure to be here on your show. A big hello and a big shout out to all the music lovers out there in NPR Radio.
So just because it's always good to have a primer, and I don't live in Texas, why don't you just kind of tell our audience a little bit about the nature of conjunto music? Just give us a little primer. And I know that you guys brought your instruments.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're doing telling, you can actually do a little bit of showing.
Sure, sure.
By playing.
Well,
so what is conjunto? Kind of walk us through the basics and where it comes from.
Okay, well, it's basically conjunto means group, okay? But back at the turn of the century where the German settlers settled in the Texas area, in the San Antonio, New Braunfels area, some of the guys, accordion players from the South Texas area, were hearing this influenced, you know, polka music, oompa music, and started playing accordion to kind of imitate the oompa sound that they were hearing on their radios and TVs and so forth, and incorporated an instrument called the bajo sexto, which took the place of the left-hand side of the accordion, the accompaniment part of the accordion.
Well, and you guys have an accordion. You have an accordion there, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
But
well,
don't leave us hanging.
Don't leave us hanging.
Okay, so it kind of sounds like this.
Actually, in that song Redoba, that's uh-huh. from your latest CD that you just won this Grammy for. So, in the liner notes, you talk about the fact that song actually traces back to the waltzes of the 19th century.
Right. So it's a similar beat. It's a 3/4 beat. You know.
So how do people dance it?
Well, it's just like a waltz. Just like a waltz, exactly. Redoba is a little faster beat. It's a little faster rhythm than the actual waltz. A waltz would be more like something like this, like, you know. You know. And so the redoba is going to be a little more steppier, a little more peppier, a little faster.
the thing about your music is that what I love when I listen to it is that it sounds just so authentic and brings back so many memories from this visceral place of being a kid and hearing this music kind of everywhere in my background of the soundtrack of my mind.
Sure.
So put those two things together for me. Well, like super hip, you know, super modern, winning Grammy Award winning, and yet really based in tradition.
We stick to our roots, which is the basic conjunto root of the polka and waltz or whatever, redovas, cumbias. But what we do is, as an instrumentalists, you know, David here on the accordion, you know, he incorporates jazz and blues licks into the traditional conjunto sound, you know, just the
so
same.
So can you do that? Can you do that for me, David? Like, what does that sound like?
Oh, yes, that.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't know about this one thing that is tied to conjunto music, which is that there's a kind of dance. Tao cauchitoso? What's it called?
It's el tacuachito.
Tacuachito.
¿Cómo es?
Tacuachito.
Tacuachito. I would have to say that was invented by in South Texas by Tony de la Rosa. Back in those days, you know, they would play really fast, you know, Narciso Martinez and Valerio and Santiago Jimenez. But Tony de la Rosa, for some reason, he managed to slow the beat down a little bit so the people would dance slower. And again, you know, the German polkas, they would, if you'd see them the way they dance the polka, it's cold in Germany, you know, it's a lot colder, so they would jump and skip. And in Texas, it's not cold by all means. It's really hot and humid. So the people, they would dance. They couldn't be jumping up in this hot weather and hot heat, you know what I mean? So they slowed the beat down a little bit, and they kind of shuffle their feet in a, what was it, a clockwise way around, you know, around
actually,
the dance
they kind of stomp their feet more to the ground.
Yeah.
So they call it una polquita de tacuachito.
Tacuachito. And if something like this, I guess we can kind of maybe slow it down and show you.
Are great.
Thank you.
That was great. Thanks so much for all of your time and for showing us and teaching us so much about the music.
Gracias. God bless you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Max Baca and David Farias are members of Los Tex-Maniacs. Their Grammy Award-winning album, Borders y Bailes, is available from Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. We had help this week from Martina Guzman and Melissa Sowry from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Visit us online anytime at latinousa.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by Civic Ventures, presenting the Purpose Prize to people who solve major social problems in their Encore careers. Nominations at purposeprize.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.